Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it is my pleasure to welcome you all here today on this 24th day of February to talk about Beyond the Jasmine Revolution and Tahrir Square, Egypt's regime change and the prospects for democracy in the Middle East with Professor Miriam Edelman. First, though, if you don't mind, I'd like to give you a little heads up on upcoming programs, one of which, continuing with the international theme, next week at the Institute for Retired Professionals, Catherine Bertini, professor of public administration and chair of the International Relations Program at the Maxwell School, is going to be speaking at IRP on March 3rd and talking about behind the international headlines and the role of hunger and poverty. Kathy has been a speaker here a couple of times, you may recall, and I won't go into her background now, but I would highly recommend that to you if you can make it next Thursday. Here, though, next Thursday morning, we will be switching gears and talking to Paul Beyer. Paul is the director of Smart Growth Initiatives for New York State within the Department of State. He started in that role under the last administration, I believe. He continues under the new Cuomo administration. And as you know, smart growth, well, he'll talk about that and what the state is doing in some regards to promote sustainability among local governments. And it touches all aspects of life. So I highly recommend that one. It relates to a lot of things that are going on in the community. So that's next week. There is a lot going on. We'll be sending out the program also with some other thoughts and ideas of things that you perhaps should not miss. But right now it's my pleasure to introduce Miriam Edelman. Professor Edelman is an associate professor of political science. She works with the Project on Democracy. She's actually the director of the Project on Democracy in the Middle East, which is part of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs. She's part of the PARC program, which many of you know as the Program on the Analysis and Resolution of Conflict, or it used to be that. They made it longer, but that's what it is. She's also taught at Arizona State University. She graduated from the University of Jerusalem, or the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and with degrees in English and international relations. She also has advanced degrees in political science from Columbia University. I was talking to her a little bit about another interesting note on her resume. From 1983 to 1985, Professor Edelman was in the Israeli Defense Forces in the Air Force. She was actually some years ago a citizen. She has a dual citizenship and was drafted into the Air Force. So she has a unique perspective also on the Middle East from years of living in that area. So please welcome Miriam Edelman.
Thank you. Thanks so much. And thank you for coming so early in the morning. Looking forward to our conversation today. Can everybody hear me good, or should I speak? I think this is probably better, right? Okay. Well, as we all know, on December 17th of last year, a 26-year-old Tunisian fruit and vegetable seller named Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire in the town of Sidi Bouazid. He was protesting demands for bribes and the humiliating abuse that he had suffered at the hands of the police. And that one act triggered the collapse of one of the most corrupt regimes in the Arab world. And not a single political or social scientist predicted it. They also did not predict the revolution in Egypt, what we now call the January 25th revolution, inspired by the quick fall of President Ben Ali of Tunisia. By February 11th, the unthinkable had happened in the most populous Arab state. Mr. Hosni Mubarak had stepped down from power. In fact, not only did no scholars of the Middle East predict the monumental changes that we have witnessed over the past several months, but even in the midst of regime change in Egypt, experts were still writing things like, and I quote, "The Egyptian state is not experiencing regime breakdown. the uprising will not seriously threaten the Egyptian regime. So, why did analysts of the Middle East, people in my field, fail to anticipate the unrest? After all, each of the Arab states, and we can look at many of them across the region, Egypt, Libya, Algeria, Yemen, Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Tunisia, all have the political and social features that would make them prone to regime collapse. There are very large young populations in most of the countries I just mentioned. Well over 50% are under the age of 30. There are massive inequalities. We've all heard about the lack of upward mobility for the educated, but 40% of Egyptians live on less than $2 per day, and nearly 30% of Egyptians are illiterate. Very high unemployment and soaring food prices in recent years. Large security apparatuses, which I'll talk about in a minute, and in particular, abusive security and police forces. Hated leaders who hold elections and allow for parliaments only to hold on to power by rigging those elections and making sure that their party always wins. Lack of due process, little free expression. Yet despite those ingredients that would lead one to expect that the days of those regimes would be numbered, the consensus among Middle East experts was that authoritarianism was deeply entrenched in the region and here to stay in perpetuity, or at least for the immediate future. And I'll just read to you a couple quotes that are very indicative of the literature. Consensus that the problem is not Islam, because, in fact, democracy seems to be thriving in other Muslim-majority countries, particularly Turkey and Indonesia, get cited quite a bit in the scholarly literature. Something problematic to the Arab Middle East, but as you can see from this quote, which is quite common, received wisdom in the field, rapid transformation is unlikely. And another quote like this, well known that there is a democracy gap in the countries of the Arab world, none of which is democratic and all of which are Muslim majority, but needing to look at the difference between the Arab and the non-Arab Muslim world. So that's another example of scholars spending a lot of time writing about the so-called democratic deficit in the region. And I think the reason why so many scholars did that is because in the field of comparative democratization, there's a tendency to try to come up with generalizable hypotheses that will cut across space and time to account for the lack of democracy. And in many respects, there was an attempt for some decades to make the field of comparative democratization more akin to the hard sciences. Rather than study the specific features of each country and the processes that might lead one to revolution but not the other, scholars look for sets of underlying conditions that were said to characterize the region as a whole. And I think, you know, that really made it difficult for scholars to capture the tenuous but real tides of change that were emerging in distinct locales. For example, nobody was really writing before this winter about savvy groups of young political entrepreneurs in Egypt and in other Arab countries who were increasingly becoming adept at using social media to spread the message of nonviolent political change. And not many people who wrote, even those writing about civil-military relations in the Middle East, were talking about growing rifts that were emerging between the state and the military in some of these countries, particularly in Egypt. Since so many officers in Egypt receive training in the United States and have friends within the U.S. military, friends who we now know would email their Egyptian counterparts during the height of the protests in Egypt and urge them not to fire on civilians. So in fact, when on January 31st the Egyptian army declared it would not use force against the protesters, I would argue that is the point when the tide was turned in Egypt. So it's critically important that the Egyptian army was listening to the American military and their counterparts there, and nobody was really riding on that before this winter. And I think that, you know, part of the reason here is these disciplinary blinders that political scientists all have. The smartest political scientists did not foresee the end of the Cold War, did not foresee the attacks of 9/11 because of these disciplinary blinders. There seems to be, in my field, a desperate need to identify with the hard sciences, and that makes it nearly impossible to theorize about the role of human ingenuity, the power of ideas, human agency, and we fail to predict the events that we have been witnessing. I think there's three reasons why the study of comparative democratization cannot approximate the hard sciences. First, human beings do not react to stimuli the way chemicals do in a test tube. Okay. Different people react in different ways to the same sets of constraints and opportunities, and this means we can never really have the predictive precision or the ability to replicate our experiments in the way that, let's say, physicists can. Secondly, states and societies vary a great deal across time and place. The Middle East of the 1960s, of the 1980s, and even a decade ago is a very different place than the Middle East of 2011. The technological revolution, whose implications for democracy building we are only just beginning to understand, has really fundamentally altered the political landscape. And third, the things that hard scientists study, planets and protons and neurons and plasmas, those things are largely oblivious to what scientists think about them. But in our field, in my field, human beings, what we study, human beings learn, they remember, they copy, they are inspired to act. And because of that, social science theories, particularly theories about democracy, can change the world if enough people believe in them. And in the Middle East, we know that poll after poll shows that the people of the region desire democracy, particularly when that is defined as accountability of the government to the people, the rule of law, an end to corruption and an arbitrary use of power. That democracy is the best system for delivering prosperity and the good life is a notion that has caught on in the Middle East a long time ago. And this is the power of ideas, and it's why the social sciences will never be like the hard sciences. Of course, governments, like citizens, can also learn a thing or two. And after the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions, the Iranian government learned a few lessons of its own. The government of Iran quickly put under house arrest two of the leading opposition leaders, Karoubi and Mousavi, the two defeated presidential candidates, thus denying them access to the protesters who were rallying in solidarity for the Egyptians and the Tunisians. Smart move on the part of the Iranian regime. The regime also used less lethal tear gas so as not to enrage protesters. That's something that happened in Tunisia and Egypt. And the Revolutionary Guards and the besieged militias were kept off the streets. Police prevented protesters from staying overnight in Azadi Square so it would not turn into a permanent focal point like Tahrir Square did in central Cairo. So I think that's interesting that governments and citizens learn lessons, and they also both use technology and Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. So in explaining, you know, how the revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia occurred, I think we have to acknowledge the role of chance, of contingency, of one-off events that simply cannot be predicted in advance. Who could have predicted that Mohamed Bouazizi's self-immolation would be a catalyst for a revolution? Who could have predicted that an Arab rap song by a young man known as El General, played over and over on Al Jazeera, would galvanize a population and that this musician's arrest would be enough to bring thousands into the streets of Tunisia? Who would have predicted that a TV interview by Google executive Wael Ghanem on February 7th would lead to crowds pouring into Egypt's Tahrir Square the following day? Who would have predicted that unrest in Tunisia would spread like wildfire in the region, sparking sizable popular uprisings that are still going on in eight countries? largely because in this one country, Tunisia, not the largest, you know, only about 10 million people, not the most important, not a geographic or demographic or pivot, really, but the perceived impossible had become the possible. And the latest pan-Arab movement of Yes, We Can was triggered. I don't think any of those events or factors could have been predicted a priori, but they were catalysts for the regime upheavals that we have seen. Take those things out of the equation, and I think that Tunisia and Egypt's former rulers might have very well prevailed and repressed the protests, just as they had done time and time again in the past. Now, all that doesn't mean that we give up on theorizing about our world or about Middle East regime change and democratization. As the anthropologist Clifford Geertz once said, we can construct in hindsight accounts of the connectedness of things. We can piece together patternings after the fact. So how might we do such an after the fact explanation of regime change in Egypt, and what would it look like? And I think we would focus on these four things first. We would focus on the security apparatus and the military. We would look at something about oil economies and rentier states. We would look at the nature of the opposition. We would look at civil society. So I want to just briefly go through those few things, each in its own. We know that in the Middle East, states have constructed, some with oil money, others by fabricating a host of internal and external threats, enormous security apparatuses. These countries spend unbelievable amounts of money on weapons and arms, and they have a very large police forces that protect the state. And just to give you some data, writing in about 2005, this data, Saudi Arabia spends 13% of its GDP on the military, as does Oman. Kuwait spends 8%. The Iraqi military spending before the Gulf War put its military spending at between 25 and 40% of GDP. And, of course, massive intelligence networks maintained in these countries. So I think, you know, abundant rents, either from oil revenues or from foreign aid, have enabled states in the region to build very repressive intelligence services and militaries that protect the state and that coerce the population. We know that these military police states are not all the same. In Tunisia, on January 13th, the state security forces, which had already killed dozens of unarmed civilians the previous week, refused orders to keep shooting, and in doing that, the next day, Ben Ali and his wife fled an angry mob. In contrast, in Bahrain, in Iran, interestingly, in Syria, which seems to have fallen off these daily discussions, the security forces have not defected. And to explain why, I think we need to look at some interesting differences that are just now coming to light, and people are starting to talk about them. In Bahrain, as in the other Gulf states, also in Libya, there's a foreign disenfranchised population, many from Asian states, that are what I would call politically neutered laborers, and they populate the ranks of the police forces where, as we are seeing, they are willing to use force against the native population. That's something we have to continue to theorize about, and I think it had important implications. The other thing that we certainly have to look at is oil economies, the particular nature of Middle East economies and the rentier state. It's not surprising that the two countries to experience such dramatic regime change are non-oil states, Egypt and Tunisia. Great quote from Fareed Zakaria. I don't know if you listen to Fareed. I know him from years back. Very smart guy. Now has a show, Fareed Zakaria GPS. But always worth reading Fareed's work. And this quote, I think, is very useful. When citizens are not taxed and are dependent on the government for subsidies and jobs, they are in a very weak position to demand representative government. For decades, the oil states in the region have bought off their populations. They've doled out oil rents. Recently, you know, as we know, the Kuwaiti ruling family offered each Kuwaiti family a little over $3,000 as a gesture to the population, but it's a bribe. It's a bribe, right? It's hush money. And it seems to have done the trick so far. Things have quieted down in Kuwait. Exporting petroleum also generates very unique labor markets. In particular, women do not participate in large numbers in the workforce in these oil exporting countries, which means that they are not politicized. And societies tend to become patriarchal, not because of Islam, but because the oil economy leaves women at home. So in Tunisia and Egypt, by contrast, women have been participating more in the last decade. They have more rights established constitutionally. They're more integral to the workforce. And it's not surprising then that those states were the first to revolt successfully. The other thing that I think we can theorize about are opposition movements. And I just put a couple of things here that, you know, might affect opposition movements, weak legislatures, and strong executives. But the nature of the opposition is crucial. In most countries of the Middle East, the opposition is divided, and different groups are co-opted by the regime. They work against each other. Often it's the secularists working against the Islamists and vice versa. But look, interestingly, at what happened in Egypt. In Egypt, the opposition movements coalesced into the National Coalition for Change, and they appointed Mohamed El-Baradei to negotiate on their behalf with the Mubarak government. And the Muslim Brotherhood, the largest opposition movement, agreed to work with the secular parties and the NGOs. And that new coalition in the early days of this revolution was very important, was critically important that that coalition had been founded, because as Rami Khoury of the American University of Beirut says, and I quote, "That coalition gave the armed forces the confidence to see that an orderly transition would occur." Okay, so these are not, you know, disparate causal factors. They are linked together. The fact that the opposition united made it possible for the military to break off from the state. And I think because in Egypt the military is so entrenched in the economy, has so much business interest that it wants to protect, knowing that there would be an orderly transition and that their business interests would not be detrimentally impacted by regime change made it possible for them to step down, okay, and refuse to fire on the protesters. And as I said before, that was the crucial point. That was the turning of the tide. That's what allowed all the people to flow into the streets and not be worried that they would be fired upon. Shift to Bahrain for a minute, where the Sunni liberal minority is also repressed, but they won't join forces with the Shia protesters despite, you know, their discontent with the Al-Khalifa regime. The Sunnis worry about the rise of the Shia majority that makes up the oppressed classes. And, you know, maybe they have reason to be worried, because history shows that oppressed majorities do not treat their oppressors very kindly when they take over power. Consider the wave of Tutsi on Hutu violence that erupted after the genocide in Rwanda. The last thing that I think is important to talk about is civil society. The U.S. has spent effort and money to expand what we call civil capacity in the region. Egypt has dozens of NGOs. Last month in Tunisia, women empowered by their involvement in labor unions, human rights organizations, working in as journalists, braved gunfire for some days. And at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University, we play, I'm proud to say, a small role in this. We've been involved in educational programmings for the last 5 years, funded through the State Department. Which brings Middle East practitioners, people involved in these revolutions, to the United States to learn about democracy, what it looks like, how to achieve it, how to build civil capacity at home. And that's just, you know, one program among dozens in the U.S., in Europe. and elsewhere that have been working behind the scenes for over a decade to facilitate these processes. But I think we need to go, obviously, beyond these explanations. We don't have good theories about entrepreneurship and how that matters. We now talk about the importance of people power, but how are people mobilized? And, you know, I don't think the Internet explains all of that. Many people have called these revolts the Twitter revolutions. And I think, of course, we have to recognize the empowering nature of Facebook, YouTube, access to Al Jazeera, access to non-government-controlled information, which has been critical in helping the youth of the region become more worldly, become more aware of the humiliation and daily indignities of authoritarian rule because they know something about the alternatives. They've been exposed to international culture and politics in the way that their fathers and grandfathers were not. But, you know, we have to remember that in Egypt, the success of the protests rested on good old-fashioned footwork, boots on the ground, flyers, paper flyers, not the Internet, you know, paper flyers in the right neighborhoods, some savvy tricking of the police forces who went to the wrong neighborhoods at the wrong time. So, you know, organizational skill may require some level of social media skill, but I don't think social media is necessary or sufficient for regime change. So let me just talk briefly, and then I'll open it up to some of your comments and questions about, you know, the challenges that lay ahead. I think, you know, the key challenge is how to move beyond regime change. There's been regime change in Tunisia and Egypt. There is no going back to the earlier period. That's over. But will regime change morph into true democracy? That is an open question. And I think for that to happen, two things have to happen. You have to have the rule of law, and you have to have a culture of tolerance. Okay, the rule of law, you know, in a nutshell, is a check. It's a check on the executive's arbitrary use of power. The citizenry, through various institutions, becomes a watchdog. It's not that bad things won't happen and the executive won't try to exceed its boundaries, step away from a constitution, try to thwart a majority rule. Yes, executives do that all the time. But are there checks on those incentives to monopolize power? And that's what you want to see. You want to see an independent judiciary, crucial for the rule of law. You want to see a free press and freedom to associate so that citizens can become watchdogs too. And you need a monopoly on the use of force. No party militias, okay, which has really been a detriment to some of these nascent democratizing regimes in Palestine and Lebanon and in Iraq, for example. But that's not all you need. Because if you have the rule of law, you might look like Singapore. But you need also a culture of tolerance, okay? You need the expansion of the franchise to include minorities, and that cannot be legislated, I don't think. I don't think it's solely a legal issue. I think it's a cultural and social issue. A culture of non-discrimination rests on social convention and mores that develop over time. Now, without the rule of law, you can have elections and you can have party competition, but they will not foster democracy. Actors will compete for the vote by using violence. And we saw this in the former Yugoslavia, and we saw this in Palestine in the 1990s. In general, mature democracies are peaceful. They don't wage war against each other, for example. But democratization processes getting to mature democracy, those are very violent processes, particularly where the rule of law is not established prior to the elections and the party competition. And then without a culture of tolerance, we're left with illiberal democracies. All the institutional features of parliament, suffrage, party competition, but none of the freedoms and the rights, certainly not for minorities, that we see in liberal democracies. Now, I was heartened recently to hear the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and key spokespersons in Egypt, the extremely popular cleric Al-Qaradawi, for example, speak in such inclusive terms about Egyptian society, including the Copts, for example. Writing in the New York Times, Essam El Aryan of the Muslim Brotherhood said, "We aim to achieve rights and reform for all, not just for Muslims, but for all Egyptians. That's the kind of culture of inclusion and tolerance that's necessary when the religious majority respects and includes the religious minority, but as we know, there can be setbacks. I think we have to remember that while events were unfolding in Egypt, in Indonesia, there were a series of attacks on the country's Christian communities on the very same day that revolts were happening in Egypt. In Java, angry mobs burned down three churches and called for the death penalty against a Christian man who had been accused of blaspheming Islam. The mobs were unsatisfied with the court judgment that had already given him a really harsh sentence, 5 years in jail. And on February 6th in Java, mobs killed in the most savage manner three members of a minority Islamic sect, the Ahmadiyya, who have been persecuted across the region. But, you know, half-hearted attempts by the state in Indonesia, by the police, to defend this minority Islamic group. And so even Indonesia, which has gone far towards democracy, there's still a long way to go before it becomes a kind of tolerant country of multiple faiths. So I think, you know, here are the ultimate questions. How to incorporate and enfranchise minorities? Should democracy protect vulnerable members of society when those values and practices are at odds with those of the majority? Can democracy privilege a religious and or ethnic majority, or must it enshrine equality and non-discrimination by law? Those are key questions. We don't have the answers in the social science field. These are matters of debate that will need to unfold in Tunisia, Egypt, and elsewhere. Think here not only of ethnic minorities and religious minorities, but also of the most vulnerable in society, the gay community and the disabled. We know that in the Arab Middle East there is a strong support for democracy, but this often doesn't translate to the expansion of rights for gay people or for the disabled. The Arab world really lags woefully behind in this area. The only country in the region that is signatory to the UN Declaration that decriminalizes homosexuality is Israel. Okay. We know that life for gays and lesbians in Iraq has gotten much worse since the fall of Saddam Hussein in a democratizing Iraq. Other examples abound. I'll just give you one. In Morocco, the king put forward a very liberal family law. Women could divorce, expanded property rights for women, raised the legal age of marriage, provided government support for housing for women who had children out of wedlock. But it was conservative societal groups in the legislature that were opposing those reforms. And there's other good examples of that occurring in places like Kuwait and Jordan. So, you know, a key question, if that's true, is should religious parties be included in the political process? Does democracy require a secular state instead? Now, the consensus in the social science literature, I think, is that the separation of religion and state is not a prerequisite for democracy. And there also seems to be an emerging consensus in my field that we should be including all political parties, including the most radical religious political parties, that leads to moderation, and that excluding them simply empowers the radicals within those groups. So once a party is allowed to join free and fair elections, and they have to work with other parties in a government to provide benefits to their voters in order to get reelected. And in time, we might see that a protest movement and a radical platform morphs into a more responsible party and a more moderate platform, maybe even a responsible governing party. Now, if allowed to participate, we know that radical religious parties receive at most 10% of the vote. Radical fundamentalist Islam simply cannot help people solve the pressing economic or political problems they face, and that's why people don't vote for those parties when they have the chance. Turkey and Indonesia are cited as good examples there. And they, I think, are starting to forge pluralistic societies that do include nonviolent religious parties. But, and I've written on this a little bit, I think that certain conditions have to be met. It's not just a blank check, include everybody, and it doesn't matter. First of all, religious parties cannot have their own militias. They must renounce violence and the use of force to achieve political ends. They must become nationalists. And I think that's why it's really hard to view Hezbollah and Hamas as moderating forces at the present time. They don't really have any incentive to moderate. They can always fall back on force when things do not go their way. Nasrallah recently stated to his followers that they should be prepared to invade Israel's Galilee. Now, only the sovereign government of Lebanon has the right to make that kind of a statement. But Hezbollah refuses to nationalize. It remains a state within a state. Secondly, I think that electoral rules need to provide an incentive for parties to appeal to the median voter, because the median voter is likely to be the most moderate in society. And I think, you know, I've done some work on Israel's religious political parties, and I think that because of electoral rules, Israel's religious parties do not really have an incentive to moderate. They develop these niche constituencies. They can always get into the legislature, the Knesset, because the threshold is set so low. And so they really don't have an incentive to appeal to the median voter, which is the largest moderate group in Israel. So I think, you know, if those conditions are met, there would be no reason to exclude, let's say, the Muslim Brotherhood from Egyptian politics. Now, the Brotherhood has been officially banned, but it had affiliated candidates that ran as independents for over two decades with increasing success. You may recall that in 2005, the Muslim Brotherhood won a historic 88 seats. Of course, that's out of, you know, 454 seats, but it's still quite a large number. And one scholar who's researched the parliamentary activities of these Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated legislators noted that Brotherhood MPs were attempting to transform the Egyptian parliament into a real legislative body, as well as an institution that would represent all citizens and a mechanism that would keep government accountable. That is, even before the regime changed this winter, the Muslim Brotherhood was already acting as a true democratic party and largely had bought into what democracy means, soliciting diverse citizen opinion and criticizing executive power. So let me end here. Implications for U.S. foreign policy. First, the U.S. must stand on the right side of history. George W. Bush was right. If we continue to support tyrants, we will be faced with a generation of Arabs who hate America, and rightly so. Of course, the Bush administration promoted democracy in the Arab world entirely the wrong way, by using American force rather than the American power of example, but he was on the right track. U.S. foreign policymakers should not listen to the Saudis when they try to convince us, and they're trying to every day, that supporting democracy in the region will lead to an Iranian takeover. The Bahraini Shia are Arabs. They are not Persians. They are not likely to listen to the mullahs of Iran. They will listen more to the Shia clerics of Iraq. The Bahraini Shia are fighting against discrimination, the rule of a minority over a majority. Over 70% of the Bahraini native population is Shia, even a greater percentage than in Iraq. Bahrain is the real apartheid state in the region. We want to look at apartheid, go to Bahrain. So we must support the efforts of the Shia community in Bahrain to gain their dignity and their freedom. And in doing that, we can correct a historic wrong. I believe that the U.S. made a big mistake following the first Gulf War, where we left the Shia opposition in Iraq to face Saddam Hussein on their own. We did not support them in their efforts. We protected our own oil interests, and that was seen as enough, and we left the Shia in Iraq to their fate, and they were repressed brutally. As Steve Kahl recently argued in The New Yorker, supporting democratic reform in the Arab world is the right strategy, in principle and in pursuit of America's national interests. The status quo of U.S. foreign policy in the region is not stable and cannot be sustained, and the U.S. must now invest in populations and not in dictators. And lastly, because I work on Israel, and I feel this is a topic dear to my heart, I think we must work to convince Israel that 2011 is not 1967. The Israelis today feel encircled. They feel a drumbeat for war. Two Iranian ships just went through the straits. This is causing mass hysteria in the Israeli media. There's Hezbollah and Syria to the north, and Iran emboldened with a regime unlikely to fall anytime soon. Shia communities across the Arab world poised to unseat secular Sunni governments, which, by the way, have been having fairly good relations with Israel of late. And now the end of the Mubarak regime, which brought a degree of certainty and stability to Israel, a regime that supported its Gaza policy and was equally fearful of the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas. So I think it's understandable that the Israelis are fearful. They fear the unknown. But 1967 is not 2011. It's important to note that in the 3 weeks of revolution in Egypt, Palestine was not mentioned very much. These revolutions were not about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They're about changing the social compact between the state and its society. And for once, the Arab world is looking within at its own problems generated by its own sclerotic leaders. And Israel is a regional power with one of the strongest militaries in the world and a nuclear power on top of it. And no Egyptian government would think of risking war with it. The peace treaty will remain in place regardless of whether the Muslim Brotherhood joins a coalition government or not. And by supporting the Democrats of Egypt, Israel has the chance to turn a cold peace into a warm one. There's every reason for Israelis to identify with the democratic movement in Egypt, because after all, Jews rebelled successfully against an Egyptian pharaoh too, once upon a time. Coming up to that soon. The U.S. must work to convince Israel that its Gaza policy is unsustainable. The new Egyptian government and the Egyptian people, secular and religious, simply do not support it and will not tolerate it any further. Israel should not stand in the way of a Hamas-Fatah reconciliation. Such a reconstituted government could credibly commit to peace. A caretaker government in the West Bank cannot commit to peace. We know from the Al Jazeera leaks that Palestinians and Israelis have come so close to a deal, and the U.S. must make it clear that Israel cannot use the present uncertainty and a false sense of siege to dig in its heels. I think that now is the time for peace, and with it, regime change and democracy, and hopefully a new beginning for the region. And thank you.
Thank you. Question here.
I think that I'm going to play the devil's advocate a little bit here with you. I think that there's an argument that democracy, a true democracy, requires an educated, informed electorate. And if we look at the history of these people in the region, they're nomadic peoples, and they're living within Western-imposed boundaries. And even though they've been doing that for a long time, I think that the history of their nomadic nature is still sort of in their blood, if you will. And if we remove some of these dictators, and definitely they are, they maybe start out as benevolent dictators and then turn into nasty people, but what happens is then you unleash this clans, you know, sort of tribal familial, that started out as familial clans roaming around the region, and there is no real rule of law. I mean, these people have sort of kept their thumbs on this sort of thing, but by nature, I think that they move back into these familial tribal regional clans who vie for power within their regions, and that also is difficult to create a national feeling because they're all out for themselves, and that also works against democracy. So I think it's difficult to just scream for democracy when I'm not sure that the countries are really actually ready for that.
And there's a question mark at the end of that. His voice was
that you're playing devil's advocate. It's a great series of actually interrelated questions there. There are, you know, I didn't mention it in my PowerPoint or in my talk, but there are a number of scholars who, they don't talk about Islam as the problem, but they do talk about tribalism. And you mentioned that. And I think that, you know, in some of the countries where we're seeing stalled revolutions, it's these very issues. Yemen, for example, where you have, and particularly the security forces become tribalized too. Okay, so, you know, in Bahrain, we know that two just defected from a very small unit that was a tribal unit almost. So I absolutely agree with you. I think that it also plays into this notion of divided opposition. But we know from quite a bit of work on democracy formation in Europe that a sense of nationalism is key. Nationalism can have devastating consequences. There can be aggressive nationalism, but there can also be a positive nationalism that facilitates and provides the foundation for a civic identity. And I think, you know, that's why democracy bodes well in Egypt, because people do feel like they are Egyptian. And they talk in that way, increasingly so. If you were to do, you know, a content analysis of speeches, even by, let's say, the Muslim Brotherhood, you'd find more and more discussion of Egyptians, we are Egyptian, in their speeches. So I think that this is a very important facet to look at. Whether tribes can democratize, whether they can learn to be Democrats, can you teach it? I think Iraq is a good case study there. I think that, you know, I talked with a former colleague who focused on the tribes in Jordan, and he actually told me that there are a lot of democratic elements to their decision making, more than we would think. I don't really study it, so I had to trust him and what he's telling me. But it's possible that we could take some of those elements and use them to help show some of these leaders, clan leaders, how they could utilize those at a national setting. So, I mean, I don't think it's impossible. I do see that there is, you know, will not be easy to do that. You mentioned something about benevolent leaders. I have spent a long time, much of my career, studying democracies and war, and democracies and peace. And if you look across history, you often find that leaders are often the moderates, and it is the publics that are pushing the leaders to war. We have to be mindful of that. And I think a lot will depend on electoral rules. Right now, I have no colleagues who are working with the transitional government in Egypt to devise electoral and constitutional rules that will facilitate power sharing. So, you know, that's, I think, central to ensuring that the public doesn't become warmongering, or that that sections of the public cannot capture or hijack the state to do what they want, as this happens in Lebanon. I mean, I think that there's a lot of merit in Lebanon's power-sharing system, but they still have not figured out how to rein in Hezbollah. So I'll leave it at that, but I think those are a great set of queries and comments as this unfolds.
Good morning. I'm very curious about the literacy rate of women in these countries and how that might have affected what was going on, particularly in Egypt. I was surprised at the diversity of ages of women whose pictures got on television, at least. And it looks like they might have been doing more than just making sandwiches for the protesters.
Right. You know, I did give you that fact of illiteracy, but in the countries where we are seeing success, of protest. These are societies in which women have had more access to education and to the workforce. I study Israeli-Palestinian politics quite a bit, and the Palestinian population is quite educated, including women, and they have been key to multiple parties in Palestine, including Hamas. So I think that that bodes well, but there's still, particularly in countries where once you go outside of the leading city, you have this dramatic fall off, men and women who simply are, you know, spending most of their time and subsistence, you know, trying to just eke out a living, and they're, you know, not really able to participate effectively in some of these debates. So I think where you have problems with periphery and the center, Libya, Yemen, certainly, I don't see the same efficacy that we see in Egypt. And interestingly, in the group that's here right now from the Middle East, the women are from Egypt and Tunisia. So that's a telling for me that in all these groups that I've been very impressed with the Egyptian women that the State Department has been, you know, sending to us through this program. They have been the most impressive in their group, both in terms of their English language and their just the training that they have to think critically that they are getting from their schooling and their education. And you simply don't see that in either the men or the women coming from some of the other countries.
You've probably heard of a movement afoot to nominate the Egyptian people for the Nobel Peace Prize. When I shared that on my Facebook page a day or so ago, one of my very smart Facebook friends came back with a comment, "Well, how about nominating the Egyptian military?" Can you comment on those two ideas?
Well, don't think I would give the prize to the Egyptian military, but they did act in their rational interest, and that rational interest ended up being coincident with the interests of the population. That's good, and that's what we have to study. But I do like the idea of spreading out the congratulations that we give, because so many people, as I noted in my talk, were involved. Not only the key young people, the Google executive, Wal Ghonim, the young man now dead who didn't live to witness what he sparked in Tunisia, who set himself on fire. You know, the heroism of multiple people still ongoing. I mean, not just in Egypt, but in Bahrain, in Libya, who are risking their lives, right, to oppose tyranny. So many people were integral to this that I think I would be hard pressed to say that one particular person or even one community needs to receive the congratulations. I think that, you know, we can even pat ourselves on the back, that USAID, right, USAID, the Maxwell School, we all played a role, you know, little by little, piece by piece, in helping to bring this about. I'm glad you did that on your Facebook page, because I think that we need to applaud the populations for what they have been doing, and we need to support those populations, even though it may be difficult, it may be fraught with uncertainty, it may be that we may be asked to move our fleet from a country or two, so be it, right? We need to support democratic movements no matter which Democrats get elected. Okay, so if there are free and fair elections in Palestine and Hamas wins, you can't then say, well, those aren't our Democrats, so we're not going to support that government. I mean, and I think that I just posted on the Middle East listserv on Canvas, goes out to about 1,000 people, a article in The Guardian yesterday about hairdressers in Gaza being told to close up shop by Hamas-affiliated police in Gaza. And they were interviewing the shopkeepers who were like, well, you know, they're taking away my livelihood, right? I don't want this. I don't want... What else do they have? Gaza, Hamas is the only going concern, right? If Hamas was allowed to participate in free and fair elections, if they continue with those kinds of shenanigans, they wouldn't gain more than a few percentage points of the vote. Okay, so I think that we need to support the populations, and we need to support the uncertainty that democracy sometimes brings, because at the end of the day, things tend to write themselves out.
Okay. We have time for one more quick question, I think.
You mentioned that in order to promote democracy, that we must lead by example, the United States must lead by example, not by military force. I recently heard the former Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, state that there's no evidence that the United States is viewed more favorably today than it was during the George W. Bush administration by these foreign countries, by the hotspots. Do you agree with that? Is the United States viewed differently today than it was during the George W. Bush administration?
Initially, after the Obama election, first off, the fact that Obama was elected was amazing to the people of the Middle East. In anecdotal evidence and polling and focus groups, people could not believe that somebody like Obama could be elected. It was very encouraging to them. And I think it reinforced their views of American democracy and the American people. Poll after poll, and you can go to these polls. Shibley Telhami, my colleague at the University of Maryland, runs a poll every year of about 8 Arab Middle Eastern countries, and you can get that off his website. There's multiple other polls, Zogby polls, and you know multiple polls that you can look at. And all of them, there's the World Value Survey, Pippa Norris and Englehart, all of them show that the peoples of the Arab world admire and like Americans. What they dislike is American foreign policy. And in particular, they dislike the support of authoritarian government by the United States and its institutions in the region, and they dislike America's perceived support, being more supportive of Israel than of the Palestinians. Those are the two issues that really rile the Arab street. But when asked whether you know they like America or they like you know the culture of America or the American democracy, very high numbers are supportive. It's the foreign policy that. So there was this uptick that we got in poll data, particularly after Obama's Cairo speech. But in the years since that speech, it kind of moved back a little bit. To where the numbers were under the Bush administration. I think that in you know supporting democracy today and these movements, and as there's more light shed on the support that the U.S. has given to nascent NGOs and democratizing groups and so forth, that will bode well for the way that the Arab world views the United States. And the other thing that's really important to remember is that these revolutions of this winter, these regime changes, whether they lead to democracy or not, had nothing really to do with immediate U.S. intervention. No invasion, no sending of troops, no Navy. No. This was homegrown. I mean, this was done by the people themselves, and that's goes back to congratulating the people of the region. And that's important. because for too long, I think the Arab people have felt they needed to depend on others to get anywhere, whether it was foreign aid or a support of European NGOs. But I think there's a certain sense of agency that they have come to accept and understand that they have, and that's useful. Because really, much of this is, and the next process is definitely homegrown. Okay, how you get from regime change to democracy is not something that the U.S. can impose. We can assist. We can provide some examples. We can help, but we can't really decide the next phase.
Thank you, Professor Ellman.